Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, with the federal government shutdown threatening November's SNAP benefits for nearly 3 million New Yorkers, local and state leaders are stepping in. Governor Kathy Hochul is exploring backup meal plans for students, and Middletown is rolling out emergency food aid. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar talks with Middletown's mayor for more details. Three Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices are up for retention this November, and the stakes are high. We'll hear from the New Pennsylvania Project about why the future of Pennsylvania's highest court is in voters' hands. New York's cannabis market is equity first and health forward. We'll talk with the state's top cannabis doctor and Wayne County Master Gardeners with tips to winterize your garden and culture reporter Valerie Manzi with artist Lexa Walsh. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New proposals by the Department of Health and Human Services will dramatically restrict gender-affirming care for transgender youth. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin exclusively reports, these rules are being prepared for release in early November.
The two proposed rules use Medicaid to try to force hospitals and doctors not to provide gender-affirming care for young people. One of the rules prohibits them from getting reimbursed for patients receiving this care who are covered by Medicaid. NPR obtained the draft text of this rule. The other rule is even more sweeping. It would make not providing gender-affirming care for youth a condition for a hospital to get Medicare and Medicaid payments at all. The new rules would not go into effect immediately, but there has already been a chilling effect on access to the care. Gender-affirming care, including puberty blockers, hormones, and rarely surgery, is not against any federal law, but it has been banned in 27 states in recent years. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened mixed this morning after President Trump's much-hyped meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 180 points in early trading.
This was President Trump's first face-to-face meeting with his Chinese counterpart since returning to office, and it seems to have produced at least a partial thaw in trade tensions between the world's two biggest economies. Trump says China's agreed to end its boycott of U.S. soybeans and ease export restrictions on rare earth minerals. For his part, Trump's lowering the tariff on imports from China, although Chinese goods will still be taxed at an average rate of nearly 50%. Stocks were lower overnight in both Shanghai and Hong Kong. Stocks rose slightly in Tokyo as the Bank of Japan held interest rates steady. Here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve lowered its benchmark interest rate by a quarter point, but raised doubts about an additional cut at the next Fed meeting in December. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military has destroyed another boat in the Eastern Pacific. He says four people were killed in the latest attack, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
Hegseth posted a video on social media showing a small motorboat exploding. He said the boat, like more than a dozen others destroyed in recent weeks, was smuggling narcotics toward the United States. The Trump administration has labeled drug cartels terrorists and claims that makes it legal for the U.S. military to destroy the boats and kill the people on board, even if they're unarmed. Critics in Congress from both parties say this is execution without trial and goes against the U.S. Code of Military Justice. Senate Democrats have demanded that the Department of Justice make public any rulings it has issued that allow summarily killing criminal suspects. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 170 points. This is NPR. Authorities in Brazil say 121 people were killed 2 days ago in a brutal police raid in Rio de Janeiro. Police in Rio say they were fighting gangs, but Rio residents recovered some 70 bodies from a ravine near their besieged neighborhood. Some residents say some of the victims had been executed. Critics are raising questions about what the Rio police were doing and why the ravine was not cordoned off as a crime scene. Sudan's paramilitary group has killed more than 460 patients and their companions at a hospital, according to the World Health Organization. Kate Barlow reports humanitarian workers are trying to help thousands of desperate people fleeing the Sudanese civil war.
The WHO said it was appalled by the killings at the Saudi maternity hospital in Al-Fasha and called for patients and health workers to be protected under international law. The city in Darfur was captured by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces on Sunday after more than a year's siege. The armed forces, against whom they've been fighting a civil war for more than 2 years, have withdrawn from the city. The UN's migration organization said more than 26,000 people have fled Al-Fasher. Mothers with babies, malnourished children, and the elderly are all arriving at the village of Tawila, where aid workers are facing what the UN calls extraordinary danger to assist them. Those unable to escape Al-Fasher face great risk. Videos posted by the RSF show them carrying out executions. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. November 1st is just 2 days away, and it's still unclear if SNAP benefits for November will be delayed or issued at all as the federal government shutdown continues. Nearly 3 million New Yorkers could lose SNAP assistance, according to New York Governor Kathy Hochul. As a result, local and state lawmakers are looking at how to get emergency food to residents in the interim. Governor Hochul said Monday she's exploring how to send students home with meals as a potential backup plan. Here's the New York Public News Network's John Campbell with more.
Governor Kathy Hochul says she's exploring whether schools can give kids extra meals to take home at the end of the day. It would be an expansion of the state's new universal school meal program. But the governor says there would be legal hurdles since the program applies to meals served in the schools themselves.
I'm trying to get real creative here, my friends, because we are in a desperate situation.
The governor says she'll announce her full strategy in the coming days. So far, she's sped up about $40 million in funding for food pantries that are bracing for extra demand. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
And Governor Hochul right now is starting an announcement in New York City about those new actions in response to the Trump administration cutting off food assistance. We'll bring you some of those remarks in a little bit once she takes the podium. But first, local governments are also springing into action. The city of Middletown Mayor Joseph DeStefano announced on Tuesday an emergency food assistance program that will provide a $50 food certificate for Middletown residents who receive SNAP benefits. Middletown will reallocate $10,000 in federal funds to provide emergency food assistance. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Mayor DeStefano about the emergency food program and what the potential SNAP delays mean for the region.
It's becoming more likely that SNAP benefits for November will be delayed or potentially, you know, not being issued at all due to the government shutdown. Tell me about the Emergency Food Assistance Program you announced this past week and who it's for.
Well, we understand this is just a seed, a program that we hope grows. But we were getting a lot of calls in my office from concerned parents, people who some grandparents who are in the SNAP program have control of their grandchildren, and they were concerned about one lady called yesterday and said she has 3 cents left on her EBT card and no way to get food. So we put together a program. We reallocated $10,000 of our federal money that's already in place and put it into this program where we can document Middletown residency and a SNAP recipient. We will give them $50 gift cards starting on Wednesday. And as the program grows, we'll be able to do 200 families to start. We're already receiving donations, and so we'll be able to expand the program. And if we get more than 200 families, we'll just continue to provide and doing outreach, both trying to get more public funds and or additional private funds to make the program work. We're also seeing now other communities have called. I know the city of Newburgh, the city of Beacon. So the other communities are looking to do the same thing. But it's a damn shame that this is the United States of America, and we have to be worried about people getting food on their table because the Congress and the president can't get together to pass a short-term bill to provide these benefits. And it's just unbelievable. I think people are shocked that the reality is finally hitting, and we'll do what we can on a local level to assist. We realize it's not buying someone's week's worth of groceries, but at the same time, we know it's helpful and people are very appreciative.
And can you share more about how residents can apply for the program exactly?
Yes, they can call 845-346-4180. It's our recreation department. They can also go online on the city website and go to the recreation department. And we can also do it on the phone. So they can do it in person, on phone, or online. If they have transportation issues, we'll come to them with the card, with the gift card on Wednesday. We think we've covered all the bases on this just as very one-shot program, but the one shot might become two shots, might become three shots, depending on funding and depending on whether the feds get the rack together.
And if, let's say, November SNAP benefits are not issued, you kind of talked through this already, Mayor, just hearing from residents who only have a few cents on their EBT card. Tell me a little bit more about the broader impact this may have on both residents, but also Orange County more broadly with our food systems and our local economy.
Well, I know the governor has started funding additional monies into food pantries. We're doing a drop-off here at City Hall also to supplement the recap food pantry. It's also hurting the economy, obviously. You know, besides people, the supermarkets are hurting because they're not people aren't shopping. I'm afraid about layoffs coming from different, depending upon how long this lasts. But the most significant is the human cost and what's happening to people. I know our school district is putting together a meal program where they'll be trying to provide at least a hot meal in the evenings for families. And I think they're opening it up to all. So I think you'll see on a local level people rallying to address the issue. It's a hell of a way to have to live in the United States. As I said, we see the community coming closer together, actually, because people are doing outreach, they're helping, and the recipients are very appreciative of the efforts. So a lot of anger right now at Washington, D.C., but for now there's a lot of appreciation for the efforts made by local governments and by the residents in the community.
And as you mentioned, these are reallocated federal dollars, $10,000, which will be reallocated for emergency relief. If, for example, let's say the program does continue as the shutdown continues, will the city then pull federal dollars or reallocate federal dollars again?
Yeah, we're looking at that, where we can pull from. This is from a federal housing program, a rehab program, where we had some excess funds. So we're looking at all of our federal programs. We're looking at the legality of using some city funds to help supplement too. We're not sure about the legality of that. But these funds that we're using are directed to benefit low, moderate income folks. So, and that's why the SNAP people will qualify, and thus the regulations about having to be a city resident. But we will look to use city funds if possible and additional federal and possible state money.
Well, this application round ends on November
Monday, 4 o'clock.
Monday, November 3rd at 4 p.m. Mayor DeStefano, is there anything else you want to add about the program or anything you want folks to know in this moment?
Well, I want people to know that there is a lot of fear out there, and I've never seen it this way, even during COVID, the fear of not having access to food. So anything people can do to contribute, whether it's dollars, whether it's donations for the food pantry, please consider it, because people are really out there. They're very desperate. They're in need, and I think we all want to do what we can to help.
Well, folks can find more information on the Emergency Food Relief Program in Middletown on the city's website, www.middletownny.gov. I've been chatting with the City of Middletown Mayor DeStefano about the city's relief program for residents. Mayor, thank you so much for chatting today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the time.
and I apologize for mispronouncing Mayor DiStefano's name in the introduction. If you are in need of food assistance or know someone who is, you can check out your county or local city or township government website. If you're in Sullivan County, Sullivan 180 has a community resource guide with local food pantries listed at sullivan180.org. As I mentioned, in New York City right now, Governor Kathy Hochul is announcing new actions in response to the Trump administration cutting off food assistance. Let's listen in.
And they asked you to try and reverse this. Use your power that was given to you by the voters of your district. Can you use that to help us and stop this from happening? And when they just ignore their constituents, there need to be consequences, because there are going to be people in rural upstate New York and in places as densely populated as here in Harlem that are going to be hurting. And they should not ignore that specter. So they're inflicting pain on their own constituents, but that's not who we are. That's not who we are. We'll always embody the true spirit of New Yorkers. We stand up for each other when we're under attack. It's in our DNA. We can't help ourselves. It's what we've always done. We are a community of neighbors. I see that out here. As I said, I was helping pack some boxes of food, and I want to thank others who've stepped up, all of those who, you know, truly care. And I mentioned some of the clergy.
Governor Kathy Hochul in New York City live right now, making some announcements in response to the Trump administration cutting off food assistance. We will bring you those news headlines later today. Right now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, more of our election coverage. The future of Pennsylvania's highest court is in voters' hands on Tuesday. Kimberly Izar digs into why these Supreme Court votes are so important. That's next on Radio Chatskill.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. This Friday's show falls on Halloween. You know what that means. Goth dance party. Favorites from the likes of The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, and Love and Rockets, along with subterranean tracks creeping up from the underworld. 7 p.m. Friday night, Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. There are 7 Supreme Court justices in Pennsylvania. 3 of those justices are on the ballot this November for retention. Justice David Wecht, Justice Christine Donahue, and Justice Kevin Daugherty. Retention elections don't grab headlines, but they shape justice for years. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Kadita Kenner, CEO of the voting rights organization New Pennsylvania Project, about why courts matter and what's at stake this Tuesday.
Election Day is next week on November 4th. Tell me a little bit about what Pennsylvania voters can expect to see on their ballots, specifically related to courts, and why that matters.
Yeah, I'm actually out in my hometown of Westchester, Pennsylvania right now, knocking on doors and engaging people with this judicial election. These are very important elections, these odd years, judicial, municipal, local elections. And unfortunately, so many people do not vote in them. And that's usually because they don't have the information they need to actually cast a ballot. So what people in Pennsylvania can expect to see this year on their ballot here in 2025 is a lot to do with the courts. There are 5 judges and justices standing for retention, 3 on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, 1 on the Commonwealth, and 1 on the Superior Court. These are all judges and justices that have been on the bench for 10 years, and they are standing for retention, asking for another 10-year term. And then we also have 2 vacancies in Pennsylvania that's also on the ballot this year. There is a vacancy on the Superior Court and 1 also on the Commonwealth Court. And so there are 2 judges that are, there's 4 candidates, 5 candidates, actually. One of the races has a third party in the Superior Court race for the vacant seat. And so there are folks that are vying for the vacant seats there in Pennsylvania on those 2 courts. So courts matter. And there's a lot to do on our judicial ballots this year. In addition, depending upon what county you live in or municipality that you live in Pennsylvania, you might also see judges standing for retention or for vacancies on the Court of Common Pleas and also on our municipal and magisterial courts in Pennsylvania as well. So there could be a lot of voting on judges this year, and your ballot most likely is going to be 2 pages, front and back, and you just start at the bottom of the backside and load it all the way up and turn it over and keep voting.
just to break it down for some folks, what kind of authority do, you know, state Supreme Court justices have versus other types of judges, let's say like a county court or a Commonwealth court, for example?
Sure. Well, I'm going to start by first saying that we need to make sure we know the difference between our state courts and our federal courts. And I say that because when you mention the courts, minds typically go to the federal court, the U.S. courts. And so this year here in Pennsylvania, one of only seven states in the entire country that get to vote for all of our judges and justices in partisan elections, we're very powerful. And so we need to make sure we know what it is that we're doing on election day so we can feel good about the decision that we're making and not skip over any of the elections on our ballot. And so when we talk about the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, the justices, the seven justices that sit there, are all making decisions and rulings based upon our Pennsylvania Constitution. And so they're going to hear cases related to our voting rights or access to abortion. They'll also hear cases related to clean air and water, all things that are guaranteed to us in our Pennsylvania Constitution. We're guaranteed a clean environment, pure water, a scenic environment. All these things are guaranteed to us. We're also guaranteed to have a thorough and efficient public education for our kids, guaranteed to us in our Pennsylvania Constitution. We're also guaranteed to have free and fair elections. And so the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania is going to hear cases related to our Pennsylvania Constitution. And hopefully they're interpreting that in a way that is best for Pennsylvanians, for our rights and our freedoms. And I'd like to lift up the fact that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and our Constitution is so different than the federal courts, and that we have more rights and freedoms granted to us by our Pennsylvania Constitution than we do in our United States Constitution. And a lot of times we don't recognize that. Now, the other courts on the ballot, like the Superior Court and the Commonwealth Court, they're going to hear serious cases as well. The Commonwealth Court heard the case not too long ago that said the way that we fund public education was unconstitutional, because we fund public education in Pennsylvania by property tax. And the happenstance of some seven-year-old's birth dictates what type of public education they receive in the Commonwealth.
Kazita, wow, I'm just thinking about these are really big decisions, from education to clean air, clean water. We talked about what would happen if voters decided to retain the three justices, for example, the term limits, etc. If voters decided no on retaining the three justices, what does that exactly mean?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because a lot of people have no idea what happens in the aftermath of this election, if justices are retained or if they are not. And so in Pennsylvania, the way the rules are is that if these justices are retained, then they stand there in the bench for another 10-year term until they actually age out. And at the age of 75, they'd be removed from the bench. They'd have to retire and be removed from the bench. So that's what would happen if the justices are retained. They'd be on the bench for another 10-year term unless they age out. Now, if Pennsylvanians do something that Pennsylvania has rarely done, which is not retain a Supreme Court justice, if Pennsylvanians decide to do that, it's going to create vacancies on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Because the only way to fill that vacancy in an interim role is for Governor Josh Shapiro and two-thirds of the Republican-led state Senate need to agree on a person, or in this case, maybe three people, to whether or not that they should sit on the Supreme Court in an interim time period. So I always joke with folks that I'm engaging about this is that we probably have a better shot at winning the Powerball than we do having Governor Josh Shapiro and our Pennsylvania Senate agree on candidates to sit there in a vacancy. The only other way for those spots to be filled would be our next judicial election, which is not until November of 2027. And then they would not be installed until January of 2028, which means we would have vacancies on our Supreme Court of Pennsylvania for more than 2 years. And I'm sure gridlock would ensue. There are some issues in which the court can't make decisions because the courts will be left with four Supreme Court justices, two originally elected as Democrats and two elected originally as Republicans. And so it's a stalemate. And if we need the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to make some rulings and some decisions about our voting rights or access to abortion or any kind of other issue that could come their way, we would be in a stalemate until 2028.
This race is one that is being very closely watched, I mean, at the state level, but then also nationally. It's also a very expensive race. I think it's about like $8 million that's been spent already. Can you help me understand a little bit about why it's become such a high profile retention election, when oftentimes retention races rarely get this much spotlight? Exactly.
Exactly. Pennsylvanians typically say yes on retention, from the lower courts to the highest courts in our land. And this year, because an anti-retention campaign was launched in 2024, at the end of 2024, initially supported by the financing of Elon Musk, and now supported by Pennsylvania's richest man, billionaire Jeffrey Yass, now this election, this judicial election, is getting lots of notoriety, and the amount of money is astronomical. I think Pennsylvanians would rather that money go to supporting public education than supporting a retention election in the Commonwealth. So it is different than what we've ever experienced here. It is historical that we have an anti-retention campaign with millions of dollars behind it to try to remove three justices from the bench. So, yeah, I think that that is what we're experiencing right now, that there is something happening that has never happened before. Pennsylvanians have only one time not retained a Pennsylvania Supreme Court justice, and that was in 2015 when Justice Nigro lost his retention election following a midnight pay increase that was given to legislators and all the other branches of government in Harrisburg. And Pennsylvanians, very upset about that happening, took their anger out on the next person on the ballot, which happened to be Justice Nigro in that year.
Adding some additional context here, just that these three Supreme Court justices in 2018 ruled to overturn the 2011 congressional map, saying that it was unconstitutional. And that map was widely criticized as being one of the worst gerrymandered maps in the entire country. I am curious just about how that ruling kind of plays into this retention elections and how it informs and what that tells us about our political systems.
It's very much one of the hot button issues for the various mailers that are going out in people's mailboxes in this moment. There's some misinformation, disinformation that has gone out saying that that very gerrymandered map that you spoke about was actually created by Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices, which is inaccurate. It was created by legislators in Harrisburg. In reality, like you said, in 2018, it was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that threw that very gerrymandered map out and ensured that we had a much more fair map put in its place that Pennsylvanians were able to use and vote on in 2020 and beyond. And so, yes, this is a problem that we have here in the Commonwealth, is that we have folks who are very upset at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court for making our congressional district maps much more fair. And not only have they launched this anti-retention campaign to kick them off of the bench because of that, they also launched a campaign in 2018 to have them impeached and removed from the bench in 2018. And then in 2019 and 2020, they tried to change the way Pennsylvania voters actually get to elect all of our judges and justices in partisan elections statewide. So there have been two attempts to disrupt the independence of our state courts based upon people being upset with our Pennsylvania Supreme Court on that 2018 decision.
Candida, before we sign off, I'm curious if there's anything else that you want to add just about the importance of this elections just a couple days away.
Yeah, we can't take this election for granted. Unfortunately, turnout rate is statewide below 30% in a judicial election. Pennsylvanians came out at 77% for a presidential election. They call these sleepy elections. They call these off-year elections. We like to call them odd-year elections. We need to realize that these elections, I would consider more important than presidential elections. They're going to impact your life quickly in your local community. And unfortunately, we give away our power, the extreme power that we have to put judges and justices on benches. We give it away when we don't vote, and we give it to someone else. And we give it to a minority amount of people to actually make decisions for us in the Commonwealth when we don't come out and vote. So I would say to anyone who's watching today, make sure you talk to somebody in your life who has no idea we have judicial elections. People think that the yard signs they're seeing are from last year's presidential election, and that is the truth. I can't tell you how many times we've gone on college campuses and students are saying, you're doing voter registration for what? I just voted. And it's like, yeah, well, we vote every year, twice a year in Pennsylvania, and we need you to vote in all of those elections. So that's the parting point I'll make here today, is that educate somebody in your life who has no idea we have an election in 1 week.
Well, I will let you get back to it and continue chatting with folks. I've been chatting with Candida Kenner, founding CEO of the New Pennsylvania Project, about why courts matter in Pennsylvania this November. Election day is this Tuesday, November 4th. Candida, I really appreciated this conversation, and I really wish you and the team best of luck as you head into election day.
Thanks so much. We're trying to knock on almost 20,000 doors here across these 10 counties. And that's actually a small number for us. There just hasn't been the opportunity to be able to knock on a lot more of these doors. And so I hope that we're knocking on enough.
And thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report. Election Day, again, is Tuesday. Early voting is underway in New York. You can find out more about the voting information in Pennsylvania and also in the Hudson Valley region, as well as information from Vote 411 and the League of Women Voters at our website, wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York's $2 billion cannabis industry was designed to be equity first, prioritizing people impacted by past marijuana convictions and community-based organizations as the state builds a legal market from the ground up. But New York is also taking a health-forward approach, one of the few states to embed medical oversight directly into cannabis regulation. At the Office of Cannabis Management, that role belongs to Chief Medical Officer Dr. June Chin. She spoke with the New York Public News Network's Chantal Destra about safeguarding patients, shaping medical cannabis policy, and what to expect from the OCM's second annual Medical Cannabis Symposium.
Thank you so much for connecting with us, Dr. Chin.
So happy to be here. Thank you for hosting me.
Of course. Now, to start out, can you tell us a little bit about your work as Chief Medical Officer for the New York State Office of Cannabis Management? What does that entail?
Absolutely. So as Chief Medical Officer for New York State OCM, I oversee our public health and education department, as well as our health science, safety, and research.
And what are some of your own long-term goals for the office?
My long-term goals for the office includes putting science and data at the heart of how New York regulates cannabis. And I'll tell you what I mean. For example, tracking ED visits, making sure there's product safety and public health outcomes with our Department of Health partners as well. I'm also prioritizing protecting and expanding our medical program so that no patient is left behind, and also investing in education, helping clinicians and communities make informed choices, confident choices about cannabis and the care that surrounds it.
And for our viewers who may be less familiar, what are some of the most common uses of medical cannabis, and how are you hoping to expand that sector?
Some of the most common uses of medical cannabis includes, number one, chronic pain. And chronic pain can stem from arthritic issues, so maybe rheumatoid arthritis. Some can stem from musculoskeletal issues, so for your typical low back pain, for example. And then sometimes there's mobility and hip issues, for example. So those are some of the issues we see quite often with chronic pain. We also see it for sleep disruption, such as insomnia, cancer care, helping patients get through chemotherapy. Medical cannabis is very effective for increasing appetite, decreasing pain, for example, during chemo and radiation, and helping patients just get through the chemo treatment that much easier.
And how is your office hoping to expand that sector in the work that you're doing?
We're hoping to expand the sector. The governor has a bill that's sitting on her desk, and we're hoping she's going to sign it soon. But how it expands it is it offers reciprocity. So medical patients that are traveling into New York from other states, you know, just think of the tri-state area, New Jersey, Connecticut, for example, up and down the Northeast Corridor. If they have a medical cannabis certification from a different state, they can shop in New York if they come into New York and use the medical cannabis products here. We are also looking at expanding caregiver abilities so that patients that rely on caregivers to pick up medicine, to help them access medicine, we make that a lot easier for them. That's very, very important. And then also provider education. We hope to bring on more providers and educate them about incorporating medical cannabis in their standard of care. And we're hoping that the bill will help alleviate some of that as well. And then home grow, patients that want to grow their own medicine. We are creating ways to expand the ease of that as well.
Can you tell us about some of the risks that are associated with medical cannabis and how your office is hoping to mitigate those risks moving forward?
Well, it depends on where you're coming from. So I say from a patient perspective, some of the risks are it can interact with your current medication regimen. So you really want to make sure that you are letting your provider know that you're starting medical cannabis. And that goes for any herbal medication, right? If you're taking vitamins or supplements or any herbal medication, you do want to let your provider know because it can interact with prescription medication. Sometimes we have elderly patients, they have to be forewarned on certain cannabis formulations that might make them sleepy, or it might be too strong, it might make them dizzy. So if they live alone, if they're getting up in the middle of the night to use the restroom, you want to take fall precautions, for example. So that from a patient's perspective. And then from a public health perspective, we always talk about safe storage. If you are a medical cannabis patient, but you have children at home, you want to make sure that you lock it up, you store it safely, you put it out of sight, out of temptation. Sometimes patients don't realize that they left it in their dresser or the kitchen table, for example, and kids and pets can get to it. So from a public health perspective, safe storage is in all of our campaigns.
And it's my understanding that your office will be hosting the second annual Medical Cannabis Symposium in just a few weeks. So can you tell us what you're hoping to achieve with this conference?
Yes, yes, yes. So OCM and Northwell Health, we're hosting that second annual New York Medical Cannabis Symposium in Long Island. And we're bridging science, bedside care, and public health practice. So we're giving providers practical tools to guide patients safely and responsibly. So the day before the symposium on November 6th, providers can come and take a CME course and become certifying practitioners. So they could learn about what cannabis science is, the different formulations out there, the pros and cons of recommending cannabis, you know, how to incorporate it into standard of care. And then the day of the symposium, we have a wonderful, robust agenda of researchers, physicians, nurse practitioners, public health specialists talking about research and what's out there, what's missing, for example, and also pediatrics, senior care. We're talking about behavioral health. We're talking about, public health, chronic pain. So really making sure that we have a robust agenda to reach all types of practitioners so they can learn the pros and the cons about cannabis care.
And how many people is your office expecting to attend this conference? And how has your office been getting the word out there to New Yorkers?
Well, you're helping us get the word out there. We have over 100 registered participants. And for the practitioner course, for the health provider course, we have over 150. And that was as of a couple of days ago. So I'm sure that number has gone up. But there is a strong interest in learning about cannabis care as legalization, becomes more widespread. Practitioners are realizing they have to be part of the conversation.
And can you tell us more about the educational aspect of your role? How are you ensuring that New Yorkers will understand the benefits of medical cannabis moving forward?
Well, I mean, legalization isn't just policy. It's really a public health opportunity, right? So we think about it, it allows us to replace stigma with science to promote safer and informed choices. So the medical and adult use markets work hand in hand. Patients need precise dosing and clinical guidance. Adult use side ensures safer tested products and reduces stigma. So that education has to go hand in hand, and we're building a culture of responsibility. We're building a culture of access that reaches every New Yorker, no matter what zip code.
And you mentioned those stigmas. What are some of the most common misconceptions when it comes to the work that your office is doing and the cannabis industry here in New York?
Well, you know, the stigmas are still there. I think a lot of patients don't want to talk about it with their health provider. They are afraid that it might taint their relationship with the health provider. The provider might think that it's a gateway to other drugs, for example. That's still there, that stigma. Some patients want to try it, but they are afraid if I bring it up to my doctor, they'll think, a certain way about me, for example. I have parents, you know, that have children at home, and they don't want to become a medical patient because they have a misconception that it's going to affect, you know, how they parent. How do they talk to their children about it? Mm-hmm. So they're not as open about it with education. So I think the stigma is still very, very deep, and we continue to educate folks about that through our public health and education team.
And how would you say New York stacks up against other states when it comes to the legal cannabis industry, medical cannabis, and investments into its growth?
I think cannabis is a complex topic, but complexity doesn't mean it has to be confusing. And I think New York has really thought of all facets, all spokes of the wheel, you know, if you will, of cannabis legalization. I can't think of another state that has a chief medical officer. We have a very robust public health team. We work with other sibling agencies, Department of Health, you know, the Office of Mental Health, OASIS, DMV. So it's a very integrative system. You know, we have a community grants and reinvestment. So we think about ways that we can reinvest into our underserved and underinsured communities. And we talk about health equity. We talk about social equity in all of the ways that we incorporate cannabis regulation as well.
And looking ahead to the next session, what level of funding will your office be asking the state for in the next state budget to support the work that you're doing?
I can't be specific about state funding and budget. That's out of my scope as chief medical officer, but that's a good question.
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for right now, but we thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
And we were speaking with Dr. June Chen, Chief Medical Officer for the New York State Office of Cannabis Management.
That's Chantel Dester from the New York Public News Network. We'll take a break, and when we come back, Wayne County Master Gardeners with tips to winterize your garden before the first frost. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on Cat's Cast. Warm autumnal days can be delightful, but what about those ticks? Dr. Saravanan Tangamani runs the Tangamani Lab at Upstate Medical University, leading the way in tick-borne pathogen detection.
No matter how difficult the time is going to be with the funding, we're going to continue to do it because for the larger good of the community, for the larger good of the epidemiology world, our work is really, really important.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As the growing season winds down and gardeners across the region brace for the first hard frost, one group is still hard at work cultivating knowledge, community, and even second chances. The Wayne County Master Gardener Program trains volunteers to share their horticultural expertise from backyard plots to school gardens and beyond. Joining us now is Ashley Sexton, a Wayne County Master Gardener, to learn more about the program. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Tim.
What is the Master Gardener Program for folks who may not be very familiar about it? And you know, do you kind of need training or can anybody get involved?
Sure. So the Penn State Extension Master Gardener Program is volunteer-led. So volunteers work within the community to share research-based horticultural information, and we host educational events. We partner with local schools, libraries, and the county jail to create gardens and educate the public. We host a basic training every fall. This year, we're not hosting one now, but we will be next September. The training runs from fall through spring, and it consists of webinars, hands-on trainings, a midterm and a final. Trainees are also expected to volunteer for 50 hours within their first year and pass all exams with at least an 80%. But if someone's interested in joining, they can fill out an application on our website or they can call the extension office.
I mentioned that you use your expertise to help folks with, you know, their backyard plots at their house or to school gardens, but also you help out folks at the Wayne County Correctional Facility with their garden. Tell us about that and the positive impact that it has.
Yeah, so right now we're just wrapping up our season here, our second season at the Wayne County Correctional Facility. We had another great year. We got to help a lot of inmates work on the garden, on pest and disease issues. But right now we're wrapping that up and we're working on a new composting system for the jail to use kitchen waste, actually from the jail, to create compost for the garden to be able to fertilize, make the jail more sustainable, and show them really how composting can be done in a really simple manner. Right now we have a 3-bin system and we're working to get that off the ground with the kitchen waste.
All right, so this cold weather is going to quickly settle in. We've seen some tastes of it already. So what are some ways that folks can winterize their garden?
Okay, so if you have had a frost, you can remove any frosted or diseased plant material. That's a great start. We had a hard frost that killed off any tomatoes, cucumbers, or other plants that aren't really hardy. So removing them from your garden beds or your pots makes winter and spring a lot easier and nicer to look at. Also a great time to take a soil sample if you want and send it to be tested so you're ready for spring. You can get a soil test kit at the Extension office for $10, and it will break down the components of your soil to see what might be missing. Plants need essential nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to grow. So it's important to have a good baseline before you plant next year. Once you receive the soil test, you'll have plenty of time to mend your soil before spring planting begins.
Well, I'm no green thumb here, but I did successfully grow some herbs in potted plants this summer, so I'm very happy about that, but they're not going to come back automatically. What should I do about potted herbs and potted plants?
Yeah, so with potted plants, you definitely want to change the soil every year, especially if you experience like a pest, weed, or disease issue during the last growing season. If you've had a great year, you could turn the soil out from the pots and kind of refresh it with new potting soil, because if you reuse the soil year after year, it reduces the air porosity needed for root growth, and it reduces the nutrients that are actually available for plant growth. So you definitely want to refresh it, even if you don't put completely new soil in the pots.
But pull out those dead plants or herbs and then reuse the soil, yeah. All right, so what else can you give us in terms of tips for winter? And then how can folks, you know, get more information?
Sure. So right now would be also a great time to plant any bulbs that you want. This is a great time to do, you know, daffodils, tulips, or hyacinths if you want a fantastic spring show. But for vegetables, you can also still plant bulbs like garlic for a late July harvest next year. Just make sure you're planting, you know, a few weeks before we have a serious frost that freezes the ground completely. That way your roots can develop a strong system before we enter this winter dormancy. And if the weather is warm enough, I have even planted garlic on Thanksgiving. So gardening if you can.
You are a master gardener. You can do that. All right. That's Ashley Sexton, Wayne County Master Gardener. There's more information at the Penn State Extension website, extension.psu.edu. Ashley, thank you so much. Happy winter.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, cultural reporter Valerie Manzi with the latest exhibition at the Catskill Art Space, and one of the artists there, Lexa Walsh. We spoke to Mia yesterday. We're talking to Lexa today. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Alex Edelman explained he never picks up those social cues saying it's time to go home.
But for me, the party starts when people are upset that I'm there.
I'm Peter Sagal. You'll never want this week's news quiz to end with special guest actor, influencer, and fashion icon Julia Fox. You're invited to an exclusive news quiz. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Something wicked this way comes.
Something wickedly delicious.
Apple pie palooza-ween.
A spooktacular fundraiser for Radio Catskill.
Grab a slice or take home a whole pie. Or enter your pie in our baking contest at wjffradio.org.
If you dare.
2 to 5 Saturday afternoon at Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Costumes encouraged at Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Catskill Art Space opens 3 bold new exhibitions this Saturday featuring Kat Chamberlain, Mia Brownell, and Lexa Walsh. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi is speaking with Walsh about her striking ceramic and mixed media series exploring grief, joy, and resistance in turbulent times.
Good morning and welcome to Radio Chatskill. Today, our guest is Lexa Walsh. She is one of the three female artists that will be having an exhibit at the Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor. And she is here to talk to us about her exhibit, Breathe With Me, Grieve With Me, Heave With Me. Welcome, Lexa.
Thanks for having me, Valerie.
Okay, so that's a mouthful. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. I was doing a residency last summer in 2024, and I was simultaneously watching the Olympics and also conflict being broadcast simultaneously. And I was just trying to bring in all of the nuanced feelings that were happening while comparing war and the Olympics. Somebody had walked into my studio and asked me about it and thought, oh, aren't the Olympics really the antithesis to war because of the sportsmanship and all of that? Yet they use so much of the same aesthetics. And we did not find an answer or a solution to our conversation, but it was a kind of trigger for this body of work. And I should say it comes from many of my works in the last few years have been based on military decoration meets Victorian mourning jewelry. And I've done a lot of work with veterans. So it seems like a natural progression to start with this work. And the words came out and I started making some banners and some little placards like mausoleum covers out of just lowly craft materials. Because I usually work in ceramics and other materials, and I had no ceramics facilities at this residency. So I was just playing around with fringe and balsa wood and embroidered letters. And those words stuck with me. And I started thinking about everything I could possibly make with those words, which was obviously going to be too many things later on when I got this show. But it was a good keeping those things in mind about how we are processing our collective angst and grief in these times. Sorry, that was a very long sentence.
Well, it's a complicated issue you're broaching. Yeah. So a long sentence is certainly understandable. This exhibit sounds like it's both kind of depressing and humorous at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I mean, I think that we all need to embrace nuance a lot more. And things can be multiple things at the same time. The yes and approach, I think, I don't necessarily have a life philosophy, but I do believe that we would all be in a better place if we could actually have conversations that are embracing the possibility of multiple things being true simultaneously, and that not everything makes sense, and then to survive and access more serious thinking and conversation, sometimes we need humor as an entry point. So I hope that some nuanced conversation can come out of it.
Now, you describe your work as an artist as social practice. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So this work is definitely not social practice. It is sculpture and installation. However, I come from both a sculpture and social practice background, and social practice is basically making things happen rather than making things. So working with people to create experiences. So for instance, in an ideal world, I have some freak flags in this show, which are, I don't know if you remember that Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song, Almost Cut My Hair.
Yeah.
And it's basically about hippies growing their hair as like a sign of rebellion. So, and I have other sort of signs of rebellion in this show. So in an ideal world, I might have a freak flag making workshop and procession, and that would be social practice. That would be going along with the objects. When I've done projects with veterans and making military decoration or plays on military decoration, I will have tea talks with veterans and lay people where we will discuss war together. And that talk would be considered social practice. I made an entire show with a a group of progressive nuns in California. And we, together, we decided on what to make. We made a kiosk that would go out into the street and people could borrow a nun, like check out a nun, sort of like a library, that they could check out a nun and talk about various things. Because in fact, most women religious are incredibly well-educated and well-versed and do a lot of really amazing work in the community and the world, especially since Vatican II, when they've been allowed to. You know, for years I was making almost entirely experiential works and not objects, and I started to feel like an event planner. So now I've gone back to making ceramics, which is like sort of the essence of just squishing my hands around in some material. And so I'm trying to work out my ideas in a more physical way now than, say, 5 years ago when I was really making more experience. However, they often go hand in hand. And next month I might make a project that is without objects.
There's a lot to look forward to in your future as an artist.
Yeah, I feel lucky because I feel like I have enough ideas and things to last me a lifetime. It's a good place to be.
Yes, it is a good place to be, and I'll pick up on that and say a good place to be. This Saturday, there is an artist talk at Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor with a reception, and there you can get to meet and see Lex's work, as well as that of Kat Chamberlain and Mia Brownell. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Thank you so much. And I hope to see you there.
Okay, me too.
Thank you to culture reporter Valerie Manzi, speaking with artist Lexa Walsh about the new exhibit opening up at Catskill Art Space this weekend. There's more information at catskillartspace.org. Well, earlier in the hour, we went live to New York City, where Governor Kathy Hochul was holding a news conference about SNAP and the impact on New Yorkers. She, in that news conference, declared a state of emergency and more than $65 million in state funds in response to expected SNAP delays. The state investment will support food banks, pantries, and soup kitchens across the state to provide about 40 million meals to New Yorkers. We'll stay on that story and stay with us as we continue to cover that later on the local edition and, of course, here again tomorrow on Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at catskillspropertycare.com. And from The Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey, it's Tom Candela from Curtain Call. This week on the show, I'm catching up with my longtime friend Gabriel Barry, acclaimed director, actor, and creative force behind the brand new off-Broadway musical, Reunions. We talk about the show's origins, its message of friendship and second chances, and revisit some of Gabe's incredible career highlights from Forever Plaid to Amazing Grace and beyond. That's Curtain Call, a podcast of Radio Catskill, drops this Friday at WJFFradio.org.
Best-selling author Gretchen Rubin shares how small changes can make a big difference in how you feel at home.
One of the things that I did was I noticed nobody was hanging up their coats. So I put a bunch of hooks inside the doors, and that made a huge difference.
Henry Rollins returns to Washington, D.C. and shares how he escaped his cramped apartment and found his lifelong friends. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, today's weather, rain continuing throughout the day and into the early evening. It could be heavy at times. Keep an eye out for that combination of fallen leaves and rain that could lead to some slick roads. Today's high 54. Rain ending early this evening, as I mentioned, and mostly cloudy overnight. Windy still, and a low 45. That wind will continue through tomorrow. Could see a shower still. It'll be cooler with a high of only 47. It's the same for Saturday's high, 47. Not as windy, but still a little breezy, low clouds. Sunday, though, 49 for the high and partly sunny. On Point is coming up next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.